From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. Hey, thank you for joining me, and I am so excited. It's always an honor to have Mark Nepo as a special guest. I believe this is the fourth or fifth time he's been on the program. Mark has moved and inspired readers and seekers all over the world. A number one New York Times bestselling author, his numerous books have been translated into 20 languages. Mark has appeared several times with Oprah Winfrey on her Super Soul Sunday program. In 2015, he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award by Age Nation, and in 2016, he was named by Watkins Mind, Body, Spirit as one of the 100 most spiritually influential living people. Mark has a new book out now, Book of Soul, where he explores our struggle to inhabit the soul on earth through a messy human life and how, underneath our differences, we can be who we are everywhere and create a path to what matters. As I said, it's always a delight to have him on the program, and he's joining us from his home in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Mark Nepo, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's great to be with you again.
It's always exciting for me and for so many around the world when you have another new book coming out. And the Book of Soul, 52 Paths to Living What Matters, will be coming out in May. And regarding your book, you said you're exploring our struggle to inhabit the soul on earth through a messy human life and how underneath our differences, we can be who we are everywhere and create a path to what matters. And I sat with that, Mark, and I thought, a messy human life, and here we are right in the middle of a pandemic, and we don't know how this is all going to unfold. And so, first of all, it's great timing, I think, for your readers to receive this book. But I'd also like to ask you, what counsel, what advice are you giving others? I'm sure you've talked about this before on other shows, in terms of resilience in these challenging times.
Well, thank you. And of course, you know from all of our talks that I don't have any answers. I'm in the middle of the mess with everybody.
Sure.
But you know, it's amazing here, and also, you know how this is with books. I worked on this book for several years, and the timing of it is way beyond me that it's ready to be in the world now.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm very struck, and I've had a lot of actually, you know, echoes of my cancer journey mm-hmm. many years ago, mm-hmm. Because a lot of what I feel, not just me, but what anyone going through that goes through individually, I feel like collectively we're being struck with here. And so I've had a lot of those echoes. And so I think, you know, great love and great suffering focus us on the moment of being alive. It's always been true. And all the traditions, their practices try to have us, with good effort, willfully get there,
yeah.
while experience always rushes us there. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a the great Roman saying that says, the fates lead those who are willing. Those who are not, they drag. And so where we're going one way or the other. But I think that, you know, I think the big thing for me right now, and it's become a daily practice, I'm sure, for all of us, is, you know, I feel like I am being pulled both outwardly and inwardly more strongly and more acutely all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the one hand, like if you imagine your arms stretched, it stretches the heart, there's more spaces in the heart, but also it's more fatiguing. And we're constantly having to negotiate between fear and peace. And so, you know, one of the things that comes up from my cancer journey so many years ago is how do we meet fear? We're not going to eliminate fear. But how do we right-size it so that it lives in us and we don't live or drown in it?
Yes.
And I think this brings, you know, all the practices become much more live and in real time. So you know, I find every day, while there's something that's beautiful about our being forced to be still, every day there's something that snags my fear. Mm-hmm. I'm almost like, look, like, where's it going to be today?
Yeah.
and then to practice, you know, here a flag is a great teacher, because a flag doesn't hold on to the wind. It lets it through.
Hmm.
And yet a flag couldn't be more immersed in the wind than when it's full out flapping.
Hmm.
And so how do we, you know, fear makes us want to hold on to that wind, grip it.
Yes.
And then I have to remind myself, no, unfurl, let it through, come back, right size.
Mm.
And that's almost like a daily prayer these days.
Mm.
And I think go ahead.
No, I was just, you'd mentioned, and we're talking about fear, and I was thinking the times that I have been hit hard by fear is often when I'm thinking about the future or the past and not the present.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that because fear gets its power from the future and the past.
Mm.
And I think, you know, even a painful moment is safe because it's known. And our fear then says, oh, if I'm in pain, is this going to be like this forever? When's it going to stop? And if we're in joy, then we fear, oh, this won't last forever. I hope I don't lose it.
Yeah.
And again, we're forced to practice to be where we are. And I think one of the things here too, in this time, is that, you know, of course, you know, the word Sabbath, and you know, Wayne Muller had a book years ago
on
Sabbath. And
yes.
Great book. And in there, you know, one of the salient things he points up is that in the Jewish tradition, the word Sabbath actually means the one day we don't turn one thing into another.
Hmm.
And we're being forced into a global Sabbath.
Hmm.
We've spent centuries bending, manipulating, trampling, turning everything into one thing or another. And of course, without excess and with heart, that's the definition of creativity and progress. But beyond that, you know, we're being forced to stop. And of course, this, I think again, you know, when I was blessed to still be here after almost dying from cancer, I was forced to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And the cancer is just a disease. But what it opened in me changed my life. And so it remains to be seen, you know, this pandemic is just a disease. But what will this open in us? And I think a lot about the generation, the young generation here, who are going to be shaped by this the way our parents' generation was shaped by World War II.
Yeah. Yeah. I like what you said about we're being forced into a global Sabbath, and it brings up, I think, the importance of deepening our roots through spiritual practice so that we can weather these storms.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, and I think that one of the things that, you know, that happens to all of us in this is we were forced, I can't go out. I can't do the thing. You know, and for people like me, you know, it manifests as I so love being able to go and be with people and teach and hold circles. And you know, oh my God, you know, of course, I am in the midst of designing an online webinar so I can be with folks. But the thing that happens for all of us, regardless of what we do in this, is, well, at first it's like, well, I can't go anywhere. But when we finally stop, that threshold goes both ways. It goes inside as well as outside. And the inner world is even greater and more vast than the outer world. And so when we can stand in the middle in our true stillness and be where we are, and get under fear, at least for a few moments, we can turn around and open the door the other way and deepen those roots. Because you're right, we do need to deepen those roots. You know, so how do we feed more than our fear?
And I would say, it gets back to the importance of spiritual practice, the need to always come back to center of some kind whenever we're thrown off, because all we have to do is listen to the news one particular day and we can be thrown off.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this also echoed something that I remember very well, is that, you know, when I was going through all that, you know, even and I had good doctors and not so good doctors, and wonderful nurses and all, but everyone, even meaning well, eventually spoke beyond what they knew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that journey, of course, I want to know, where am I? What are the next steps? And then beyond that, it wasn't helpful. And I find out with the news, you know, that no one knows where this is going. And so, yeah, what's happening? I want to know that. What are next steps? And beyond that, then people are just tumbling with their fear of the unknown, except they have a camera on them. It'd be more helpful if they just said, I'm afraid. Aren't you?
Yeah.
And I think that we're being asked to become intimate with the unknown. And we are so afraid of that as human beings, especially in the modern world, that we would prefer a dark certainty than to have to face ambiguity.
How true that is. It seems that the simplest and most difficult practice is seeing things as they are.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that becomes a daily practice that it is the simplest and the hardest thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how important is the work of self-awareness, especially now?
I think self-awareness is crucial, and let's understand it as not some esoteric, introspective pondering, but as everyday human course correction. You know, the work of self-awareness is, I'm hooked by that moment of fear.
Yeah.
Can I recognize it? Does it tumble me and wrestle me to the ground for days before I say, oh, wait a minute, I know what this is? So the work of self-awareness is that I don't eliminate the things that are human about me, but I become aware of them so that I go, oh, I recognize this. Yes, I know this. And then we can course correct. We can do something about it to come back to it. And I think that what's so important about that, and you mentioned about being centered, and I think that the roots of the tree is a great example, because a tree, and certainly we know a tree can be uprooted in a tornado or a hurricane, but most of the time, if a tree has strong roots and a wide trunk, it will be able to sway at the tallest heights, even in winds that might break some of its branches. But that tree will endure the storm.
Yeah.
And so we are being asked to, and you know, some people will say, I've had people say to me, well, how can I don't have time for the inner life, man. You see what's happening out there? And I feel this is exactly when we need to deepen our roots and widen that trunk, so we have one foot into the ground of spirit, and we have, or both feet, and we have our arms to the sky, you know.
Yes.
Feet in the ground, arms to the sky, heart open to everyone.
Yes, yes. Regarding COVID-19, when it started affecting almost every country on the face of the planet, it reminded me that we are all connected, sometimes even in tragic ways, and therefore we all need each other to not go back to normal once this lifts, but to perhaps create a new normal. And I was struck by something that you wrote, and it's on your website, concerning this new book, The Book of Soul. About the book, you say, "It seems the purpose of suffering is to exhaust us of our differences, and the purpose of love is to awaken us to how we're at heart the same. Then we discover that the temple is the world." And I just thought that was so beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I feel like we are, it's very, you know, hard and beautiful that we are being asked to enter this. You know, I think, you know, just one more parallel from my journey years ago that's come up for me is, you know, when I was first diagnosed, I went through a door, I went to a doctor, and when I got diagnosed with cancer, the door I had gone through that afternoon was gone. There was no, the life I had before I went through that door was gone. There was no normal to return to. And I feel in the last month, you know, 6 weeks we've been sheltered now, I have come to feel that for the whole world, there is no going back. And we are being challenged to certainly grieve the loss of different things, but we're also, I think, being asked, once we get a little more settled here, now that we've been forced to stop and be alone, what is coming into view? What is arising that we would want to reclaim and inhabit going forward?
In this book of Soul, 52 Paths to Living What Matters, Mark, what are you trying to explore with this book?
Well, yeah, with this book, and you know, they never, not one book has turned out the way I first imagined, because it's alive, you know, it's alive, and it's one of the hardest things to teach young writers. Me too, when I was young. As you know, if it veered from my vision, then I failed. No. It's first coming alive. No. It's the other way around. It's as if the mystery is saying, now that I see you're serious, I'm going to show you what this is really about, you know. So with this book, I found myself constellating teachings throughout my life, the thresholds that were opened in the other books that I have now been with, and they were kind of coming, this and this, they lead to this. And so the kind of central metaphor for this book is that we all know that, you know, of course, we're here by the blessed commitment of our mothers who bore us in labor and brought us into the world. And once here, we enter, and this is a metaphor, a second labor. And that labor is a lifetime of human experience that births the soul on earth. And everyone has to go through this. And as with all my books, you know, I invite readers not to speed read them, but to stay in conversation with their lives while they read them and to take their time. And so I provided a little structure to help with that. And so that's why there's 52 chapters, so that you could, if you want, you could read a chapter a week and live a week and come back in conversation and have a journey over a year with your own experience of your soul birthing in this lifetime.
That's what I love about this book. It is written that way, and your writing is so beautiful, and it goes deep. It causes people to want to go deep, but at the each of each writing, there's questions to walk with, and people are encouraged to journal, and so this is really a great book for people to get, and also with others to walk through their spiritual journey this year.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I've often feel when I look back, you know, I feel it's the poet in me that was born with a capacity to see, but it's the philosopher in me that tries to make sense of what I see. But it's the cancer survivor in me that asks the questions: how do we apply this to our lives.
Yeah.
I know, because the only things I've come to believe, the only things that remain abstract are things we don't personalize.
Mm. Mm. How has this book evolved where your other books leave off?
Well, I think that, and a great metaphor for that is, I feel like all of my books, and I think any seeker's books or trail of your insight, it's as if I'm walking along the shore of an ocean, you know, and I got, you know, a bucket, and I scoop up as much as I can in one bucket, and I go, okay, I guess that's a book, and then I come back with another bucket, and I keep walking. And every time the bucket, the shape of the bucket might be different. It might be see-through. It might be ceramic. I don't, you know, might be tin. But each bucket is a book. And, you know, my hope is that I take that water so that others can drink from it, and myself. And so I think that, you know, it was Newton who said, then I can answer you more specifically, but it was Newton had this beautiful thing at the end of his life. He says, I feel like I've just been a small boy playing with shells along the shore while the ocean of truth still waits in front of me.
Oh, well, I love that.
And isn't that amazing? And I think that was in response when someone, you know, was praising how wise and how learned he was. And he said, oh, no, no. You know, I've heard the sea of truth is still out there and I know nothing. And, but I think that, you know, this book has, I think all my books have been, you know, what I offer are examples, not instructions. And, and so these are the trails of my own inquiries. And I think that when I look back, there's some sense or order or harmony, which was not there living it at all. You know, if I look back to the Book of Awakening, then, okay, awakening, how do I stay awake? You know, there's always, I'm not writing about what I know, I'm writing about what I need to know.
Yeah.
And then after that, an early book was The Exquisite Risk. Well, once awake, I've got to learn how to take risks. And then the next book was on inner courage. Well, awake and having learned to take risks, I need to learn how to be more courageous. And then with 7,000 Ways to Listen. So in retrospect, they make great sense. They were not, didn't make any sense when I was writing them that they were connected. But so now we move forward. And I think the real kind of question here for me that was how this book is a culminating so far another threshold is what you read about the temple is the world, that, you know, that what's sacred is everywhere. And we, our challenge is to be who we are everywhere. And so this book is an inquiry into that and how, yes, we practice sanctity in temples and mosques and churches and sanghas and dear company of friends and family. But the real reward for that is to the temple is the world. The temple is life. There's no walls to that temple. And how do we move from any temple that has walls to the temple is the world? And I think that's at the heart of this book.
Yes, yes. The temple is the world. You could almost then say that life is our guru.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it manifests in so many forms. And this is why, you know, for a moment, this is why I think that in the West we misunderstand the great, beautiful plethora of Hinduism. You know, we in the West who are mostly monotheistic, you know,
yes,
we cast an eye in the last, especially in the 1800s and the early 1900s on Hinduism and said, oh, look, they're all pagans. They have 45 gods. They got a god for everything. And no, we missed the point. You know, life is the guru, and life is so ineffable and so mysterious that it's like a prism. You need so many facets of a prism. And so in the Hindu deity, in the Hindu cosmology, no, they don't have just one face for God. They have hundreds. And they all contribute to the one unnameable God. You know, the Upanishads in Hindu, which are the sacred scripts, the sacred textures, that word actually means instructions at the feet of a master. And since they were supposedly written anonymously, it is believed that those scriptures are instructions at the feet of an unseeable master, light.
Yes, yes. One of the quotes you chose to use in the front end of this book, I believe it was from Anthony Doerr, was, "Don't you want to be alive before you die?" And so could you describe the journey that this specific book takes us on?
Well, it moves through, there's four sections to the book. Mm-hmm. And, the first is our walk in the world. You know, that we learn, you know, Emerson talked about how, you know, our experience, every experience offers us a word in our own wisdom, and we don't apprehend it till we live it. And so our walk in the world is how we learn and how we deepen. And then from that, the second section is our true inheritance. What is our true inheritance? What is it that we that is our natural, native connection? You spoke of how we're all connected. How do we recover that? And the third section, which comes, the phrase comes from a quote by Einstein, is widening our circle. You know, Einstein spoke about how we all have our own small circles of family, friends, and he said what compassion is really about is when you realize that there's no circle, that, you know, we're this close to everyone.
Yeah.
And that's where in the Native American tradition, their fundamental part of their worldview, I'm sure you know this, is all my relations. Everything in existence is part of the family of existence. Mm-hmm. We're related to everything. And the final section of the book is, so, okay, if we can walk in the world, if we can at times reconnect to our true inheritance and widen our circle, okay, how do we help each other stay awake? Helping each other stay awake. And again, I don't offer any answers, but paths of inquiry where each of us can discover our own gifts and our own wisdom.
Yes, yes. And that is what is so crucial, I think, and actually it's a hallmark of everything that you're about and all the books you write. You Mark, you also speak a lot about our struggle to stay open. How does opening help us live more fully?
Well, every crack is an opening, and staying open in life, And there's several traditions that speak about this, but, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, a spiritual warrior always has a crack in their heart so that the mysteries can get in. We have to stay open. And a spiritual warrior is defined as someone committed to a life of transformation, not a military warrior. And you know, likewise, the heart needs to be open. It's interesting, in the Chinese tradition, there's a phrase, a sentence really, that says, it's in a book called The Doctrine of the Mean, and it doesn't mean mean-spirited, it means the middle way. And there's a line that says, given sincerity, there will be enlightenment. And, you know, that led me, I'm not a word geek, just because I'm, love words, but I'm interested in the origins of words, because words like boulders and trees and fields are eroded over time. And I have found when I can go back with words, they often offer us more whole meaning and more useful instruction. So that's why I'm interested in where words come from. So to go back to this, I was interested in the word sincere. And I found in the West, the word sincere goes back to the Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance, when there was so an unprecedented amount of talented painters, sculptors, musicians, writers. It was amazing. And so there were so many sculptors that stone cellars were as prevalent as hardware stores. And as today, you know, there were honest stone cellars and fraudulent stone cellars. And the way a fraudulent stone seller would pass off a cracked piece of marble is they would fill the crack with wax, polish it, and sell it as a perfect stone. Well, sincere in Latin means without wax. And so an honest stone seller didn't hide the flaws in the stone. And very quickly, you know, teachers of the time came to say, look, a sincere person doesn't hide their flaws. They have to stay open so the mysteries can get in, so the light can get in, and so the truth can come out. It's both ways.
Mark, can you also speak to our challenge to both survive but also thrive?
Yeah, so this is, I think, something that is archetypal, that is every person who's ever lived and will live will have to negotiate. And together they are twin lifelong skills that no one can teach, but everyone has to learn. But they're like two good legs. You know, you need two good legs to walk. You need two eyes to have depth perception. And you need to survive and thrive. And so what self-awareness helps us with is that often they require different kinds of focus. For instance, to survive in the outer world of circumstance means we have to manage risk. That is, you and I could have this conversation, and if we're engrossed in each other and we're walking across a busy intersection without paying attention, we could get hit by a truck.
Yeah.
You have to survive. You have to manage risk so we can stay in the conversation. However, in order to thrive, we have to enhance risk. You can't thrive without deepening and extending your risk. That's why I had to write The Exquisite Risk and why I had to write about inner courage. It's very easy without self-awareness to confuse the two. It's very easy, and if we manage risk internally, we suffocate. We become numb. If we exaggerate risk outwardly, we take needless risks and put ourselves and others in danger.
Yes. Well, and risk requires great courage because a lot of people aren't willing to take risk.
Well, We find out through great love and suffering that, and this was, you know, D.H. Lawrence has a poem called Self-Protection, in which he asks the question, is the best self-protection being who we are or hiding who we are? And I would say to you, it's being who we are. So we wind up taking risk when we finally are opened enough to realize, no, the safest thing is to be who I am, not hide who I am. That actually hiding who I am will hurt me because the cost of suffocating inwardly, I have learned, is greater than any hurt or rejection I can suffer outwardly. Not to minimize, I can be hurt and rejected or treated poorly. But again, if the roots of that tree are deep and the trunk is wide, oh, it'll hurt. But that it won't bring the tree down.
Yes. Can you say more also about the nature of meaning, truth, and kindness.
Well, I think that, and that's an opening chapter in the book, and you know, meaning, truth, and kindness represent three, you know, like we have in nature, we have fire, air, water, earth, you know. Well, meaning, truth, and kindness are three of the spiritual elements, you know. And I think truth comes to us through presence. Mm. When we're present, we feel truth. There's nothing in the way between living things, between us and each other, us and a tree, us and whatever it might be. And meaning comes through relationship. Meaning comes through relationship. And so, you know, that is, when I'm present, I'm certainly open to my own experience, but if all I'm left with is my experience, oh, brother. Because paradoxically, so one of the rewards for presence is I get, therefore, once I'm present, to be able to feel your presence. And meaning is what surfaces between our presence, both of our presences. And kindness is how, you know, love. So you could say under those is presence, relationship, and love are the deepest kind of spiritual elements which everyone has to inhabit personally. We have to have, I like to say, how do we befriend these things?
Mm.
Not grasp them, not understand them, because, you know, it's a difference if I'm your friend versus if you're a concept to me.
Yes. Yes.
So a lot of what the book tries to explore is how do we befriend meaning and kindness and truth? What does that look like in our individual lives? You know, it was Martin Buber who said that the world is incomprehensible, but it is embraceable.
I love that. This book is filled with so many powerful, inspiring, beautiful stories. Not to put you on the spot, but could you share a story from this book?
Oh, sure, sure. Is there one you had in mind, or?
There was a Peace Corps worker.
Oh, yes, that's a powerful one. So this is with and he learns from Kufa.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so this is a story that was told to a Peace Corps worker, and as the most truthful story, and it was then told to me. And this was a story, he was in Africa, West Africa, and there was it was a part in Africa that was very dangerous. There were lots of bandits and, you know, assailants, and to move from in the center, in the interior, from the city to the coast, where there was the next city, was like a 6-hour journey by car. And it was very well known at this time, I think this was in the 80s, that you really, if you were going to drive that, you didn't want to be on that road when the sun went down, because your life could be in jeopardy. And this man, Kufa, and I all wonder where he is now, you know, but he told the story of how he was driving, and along the way, he was on track to get to the coast before the sun went down, and on the way, he came across someone who was hurt in an accident on the side of the road, and he said, well, you know, he seemed okay, but not okay, and Kufa said, I was torn. If I stopped, I would not make it to the coast by nightfall, and I didn't know what to do. And so he decided that he would go to stop at the next small town and send word and let people know. And so he got to the next town, and he went to a hospital, and there was no one to send. There was no ambulance. there was no ambulance driver. So now what? Does he go back or does he go to the coast? And this man said that he went to the coast, but at least at the time of this telling, there isn't a day he hasn't thought about that person he left on the side of the road.
Yeah. A missed opportunity.
Mm. And a missed teacher, you know, because those opportunities are all teachers.
Absolutely.
And yet, this is at the crux of survive and thrive, because on the one hand, yes, he would have been in danger if he didn't get there by night, but this other person's life was at stake too. So now we're in the thick of it.
Yeah.
Which we are today, everywhere.
Exactly. Exactly. In your book, in the section Our True Inheritance, you talk about spiritual warrior, and you write, when we speak of being a spiritual warrior, a concept referred to in many traditions, we're describing a journey of transformation that is steadfast in its adherence to both love and truth in the face of the constant storms that life on earth generates. Mark, what does it mean to be a spiritual warrior in our own time now?
Well, I think in our own time, and there's a part of that section you read from, which also was very powerful in terms of, which applies today, but it's a word, it's the root of the word for the word war. And the word war goes back to, I believe it's W-E-R-S, wars was the Indo-European root. And that meant confusion.
Hmm.
So this is where it's very applicable today, because what causes war inside each of us and between us is confusion. And to be a spiritual warrior is to be committed to clearing confusion so that love can show itself as the greatest principle.
I love that definition. And we need that now more than ever, don't we?
We do. And if anyone's listening, if that touches anyone, then I ask you, so I can't tell you what that means for you. I'm trying to figure out what it means for me. You know, when we get off this call, that's my question every day. So what does it mean for me today to clear confusion in me and around me so that love can show itself as the greatest principle? What does that mean in terms of what we're, you know, all the, you know, the incredible fear that is running rampant now? Because fear is the other virus.
Yes, yes.
And like we said earlier, I mean, we all are dealing with it. But you know, if you ask fear what to do, it will always tell you to be more afraid. The fear is to be moved through, not obeyed.
It's interesting what you said. It reminded me of something Andrew Harvey once said, and he said, in terms of sacred activism, and he said, acknowledge the darkness, but don't stare at it, because it'll stare right back at you, but focus on the light.
Wonderful.
Yeah, focus on the light, yeah.
That's wonderful, yeah. Let's not be hypnotized. And if we are, not to judge ourselves, but to course correct.
Yes. Yes. This new book, The Book of Soul, 52 Paths to Living What Matters. What is your hope for anyone engaging with this book?
Oh, you know, that it will help them know their own soul and truth and kindness better, that it will help them expand what is their temple in the world, that it will help them be a spiritual warrior and be better equipped to clear confusion in them and around them. And then when we, you know, meet and I'm confused, they can help me.
Could you also talk, Mark, about some of the offerings you have for the public through your website?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So So right now, of course, a lot of things are being rescheduled in-person things, but I am just finishing designing a three-session webinar that will be online in June. And it won't be May 4th when the book is published. We're just getting that kind of all so to go live. That will be going live as well, and it will be at a website, a sister website that's live.marknepo.com, and that'll be live May 4th, and the book is published May 5th. So I'm hoping to be with a lot of people through these online webinars right now.
I want to encourage all my listeners to visit you online at marknepo.com. I have enjoyed reading this new book, The Book of Soul, 52 Paths to Living What Matters. And once again, Mark, it's always an honor to have you on the program. And I want to thank you again for the light that you continue to shine in our world. It's needed more now than ever.
Well, thank you for your work. And it's always a joy to dive back into this conversation together.
In closing, I'd like to read a final section in Mark's book. It's entitled, The Temple is the World. And he starts with a quote from Buddha, which says, thousands of candles can be lighted from a single candle, and the life of the candle will not be shortened. Mark writes, so much to take in and only to let out. So much to learn, only to accept how little we know. So much to resist, only in the end to surrender. We're refined as we go, made translucent enough to reveal the hidden qualities of being alive, all to regain the simplicity of a dog or a plant, all to find that the space under trouble is our home. There's one more story, at least for now. A young man determined to find the meaning of life begins his walk in the world. At first, he thinks everything he sees holds the secret. He crosses a river and feels certain that life is like the river, washing us against our will into a greater sea. Then he climbs the mountain on the other side of the river and feels certain that life is like the mountain, bare and unmoving the higher we climb. And then he enters a city and feels certain that life is like the crowds of people, so close and yet knowing very little about each other. And in time, he starts to forget what he was after. It's then he meets his teacher, quite unexpectedly. She knows, before he speaks, of all he's seen and wondered. She greets him with this question. And so, do you want to know how all this works? Or would you rather apprentice in your true inheritance? He doesn't understand all that she says, but her presence makes him stay for several years. They talk in the mornings, but mostly he mimics what she does. After she chops wood, he sharpens the blade. After she empties the water, he goes to fill it, and after she talks of the inheritance of being, he asks question after question. And more than finding answers, he grows to love her. This seems to be the answer for everything. Shortly after he grasps this, she dies, as if she were waiting for him to learn how to love before she left. In his grief, he tends her chores for months without her. And then in a dream, she whispers, you must go now and widen your circle. And so he leaves and continues his walk in the world, except everything is more colorful, and he senses the presence of his teacher everywhere. And so he meets everyone with love. He wanders through cities listening to strangers. He wanders through farm country listening to cows. He wanders into the forest where he listens to the birds and trees. For all he sought as a young man, he's now finding the same moment, no matter how far he travels. And when the same moment opens, he walks through that moment into the center of all things. All this makes him terribly sensitive to the plight of others. In time, a young man like himself finds him and calls him his teacher. He laughs, never thinking of himself in this way. But remembering the goodness of his teacher, he gently deflects his student's admiration, saying, "We're only helping each other stay awake." And so it goes. I wish this journey for you. I hope that everything in the world will speak to you. The river, the mountain, the city, the forest. And I wish you many teachers who will bring you to yourself. When we lift the pail together, something happens, akin to stars sparkling in the night. I've run out of ways to describe the journey. Only know this, that in place of wings, God gave us love. That's Mark Nepo's new book, The Book of Soul, 52 Paths to Living What Matters, and you can visit him online at marknepo.com. And that is today's program. Again, thank you for joining me. I want to thank my engineer, Aaron Duvall, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for making this possible. I'm Richard Brendan, and you've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.